You're listening to Warm Winter Words, Apollo Bay WordFest Sunday afternoon event. This digital event is a collaboration with the First Time Podcast. WordFest takes place on Gadigal Bunud country, and we pay our respects to the traditional owners of this land and the lands on which you are listening, for they are the original storytellers. We hope you enjoy the full festival experience, sitting back and listening to all three of our guests today, Tony Birch, Lucy Treloar and Michael Veitch, who are all in conversation with Kate Mildenhall.
Lucy Treloar is the author of the novel Salt Creek, which won the Indie Award for Best Debut, the ABM Matt Rochelle Award and the Dobby Award, and was shortlisted for prizes including the Miles Franklin Literary Award and the UK's Walter Scott Prize. Her latest novel is Wolf Island, which was shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Literary Award for Fiction and the ABM Literary Fiction Book of the Year 2020. Lucy Treloar's short fiction has been published in Sleepers, Overland, Seizure and Best Australian Stories, and her non-fiction in newspapers and magazines including The Age, The Sydney Morning Herald, Womankind and Mianjin. A graduate of the University of Melbourne and RMIT, Lucy works as an editor, writer and teacher and plies her trades in Australia as well as Cambodia, where she lived for a number of years. Lucy now lives in inner Melbourne with her family. Welcome, Lucy Treloar, to Warm Winter Words for Apollo Bay Festival.
Thank you so much for having me. It's just lovely.
In an interview on the ABC, you told Sarah Lestrange that you seem to have a deep connection to watery places. In both your novels, Salt Creek and Wolf Island, water shapes the experience of your characters. And I wanted to ask how you've been shaped by the watery places in your life.
Oh, gosh, that's so interesting. I actually had this student once who was a psychotherapist, and I said to her, "What is going on with this water thing?" And she just looked at me, nodded and said, "It's all about emotion."
Right, okay.
And I just thought, oh, right, okay, that explains it to an extent. But I think my big connection to watery places is about this magical beach place that has been in our family for 100 years or more. That we've always gone to, and it has this sort of almost a religious pilgrimage quality. It's in South Australia. And when we were children, every school holidays, we would just, the end of the school day, bags packed in the car that night, and we'd head off. So I never really knew what Melbourne was like in the holidays. And we would just get there and we ran wild. Like, we'd never wore shoes for the entire summer. We hardly showered. We were just these kind of salt-encrusted, tiny, wild things. And we've kind of maintained this connection with our kids. And, you know, we always go there, and this is the place they dream of, that they feel this huge connection to. And I think it is, for me, if I'm writing about a watery place, I feel tapped into that place that I adore. So I'm kind of, even though I'm writing about, say, the Coorong or the Chesapeake Bay, what I'm really doing is writing about this extremely special place that I love and, you know, would protect over anything that I always want to go to, that I feel kind of most myself in, I guess. Mm. So I think there's that. But I also think those watery places are the sort of in-between places. They're liminal places. Mm. They're neither really land nor really sea. They're that kind of connection point between the two things. And I think that has huge possibilities for exploring in a kind of novel and how you tease out what the metaphorical possibilities are of that connection between land and sea in terms of your characters. I think that's the material that I'm kind of looking at, probably not that consciously in that writing moment.
It's such a wonderful metaphor in your latest novel, Wolf Island. Wolf Island is the story of Kitty Hawk, who, along with her wolf dog girl, is the final remaining resident of an island in Chesapeake Bay, an island which is slowly being devoured by the sea. One night, her granddaughter comes ashore desperate for shelter, and Kitty is at first reluctantly, but then really wholly drawn into the troubles of the world on the main. Can you tell us, Lucy, where your fascination for this place began and describe your travels. I know you've travelled to Chesapeake Bay for your research.
I came across this book one day when I was procrastinating. I'm a very gifted procrastinator, and I think we're always taught that we should maintain focus. But honestly, I'm a big believer in procrastination. Some of my best, all the things that I feel most connected to have arisen out of this kind of idle doodling through different websites. And while I was looking, I don't even know what the website was now, one day I came across this image of a large white clapboard house that filled up almost the entire surface of an island in the middle of this blue sea, blue sky, blue sea, white house, and this little orange bulldozer kind of bobcat pulled up at the front door like it was the family car. And these islands all through the Chesapeake Bay are just kind of falling into the sea, subsiding, or getting eroded. And it's partly about it being a very mutable landscape, but it is also it's related to rising sea levels. And, you know, there's huge tracts of land that are getting lost all the time in the Chesapeake Bay. So I saw that and I just thought, oh, there's my next book. It was just like this little, there you go. And then I thought, oh, this is going to be so much trouble. But it was just already, it's too late. I've been zapped by that idea. It was like being shot with a harpoon or something.
Such a wonderful description, Lucy.
That's it. I'm stuck in this book. And started reading about it, and very, very quickly I had a vision of this woman, a woman in kind of late middle age. She's probably, you know, roughly my age, I guess, in a way, although I am way, way, way not moving in that direction, looking out of the upstairs window at this disintegrating world. And she was Kitty Hawk, who's the protagonist of the book. And then I just had to go through this process of exploring, finding out about that world. So all I had was an image and this character. And I was really lucky to get an Australia Council grant to go on a couple of research trips to the Chesapeake Bay. So I went on these two long, I was there for about a month each time, hired a car, and I would just go out driving each day. I drove thousands of miles. First trip was in the winter, and it was very kind of mysterious and shut down, very muted colours, this kind of cold, incredibly beautiful greys and these sort of russety tones of all the reeds in the marshes that are surrounding the bay. It's a beautiful landscape. And it was frozen, and, you know, there were a few birds around. And I just kind of drove around, and I would get out every now and then and sort of explore. There's a lot of ruined houses there, and I got quite adept at breaking in. Is probably not quite the right word, because it didn't take a massive amount of breaking, but I would just kind of go and test the doors and just, that seems to be all right, and I'd walk in. And then they're just so odd, this kind of walking through these abandoned houses, and I could see the remnants of abandoned lives everywhere I went. And so I just walk through these odd houses. Sometimes the staircases would have fallen in, the roofs would have fallen in, and I would just kind of test with my feet to see if it was safe to keep going and just keep on exploring. And there's so much of that, you know, the smells of those things, exploring your way through these abandoned lives that kind of soaked into me in a way, I think. So I felt like I was really thoroughly impregnated in that world. Yeah. I probably couldn't have done it without those trips.
Was at that point, was Kitty Hawk in your head? Were you hearing her voice at this point as well? Was she telling you parts of the story?
Yeah, I would have been developing the Kitty voice before I started travelling. And so I had her kind of, as soon as I could feel her voice, and I'd practice writing it, and all the time I'm writing, I'm kind of murmuring away, like, you know, it's like a crazy person. It's just like Kitty's there going chat, 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 and I'm going, wait a minute, Kitty, and, you know, right, right, right. So I had her there the whole time, acting as a kind of commentator on things that I was watching. And I never know quite whether I'm inhabiting the character or the character is inhabiting me, but most of my interior talk would have been in the Kitty voice that I developed. Yeah, so she was there on all of those travels, and then I would make notes in that kind of Kitty voice. And I suppose while I was travelling, I was refining the Kitty voice and feeling more sure of it and more sure of what she was like as a person.
You've spoken in an interview I've heard about not, as the author, not judging Kitty and the decisions she makes. And in a piece you wrote for Mianjin, which was actually about Salt Creek, you say, many writers are in fact confounded, surprised, and distressed by their characters' thoughts, actions, and choices. In what ways did Kitty surprise you in her behaviour or decisions?
There's a couple of ways. I sort of can feel a connection with Kitty in that she's a little bit ruthless about her artistic impulse. Mm. And she makes a decision when her children are teenagers that she can't stay on the mainland because it interferes with her artistic impulse. And I remember thinking, I probably would not do that. But it also, in a way, is a metaphor for what I was doing when I was writing Salt Creek. I just thought I had an opportunity. I had a little bit of time, a little bit of give in my life. And I had this contract to write a book. I thought I'm going to write the book. And my daughter was doing year 12 at the time. And a couple of years ago, I said to the family, Catherine was so easy, wasn't she, when she was doing year 12? Wasn't that great? She was a piece of cake. And everyone just turned around and looked at me and said, are you crazy? Being upstairs, kind of emotionally absent in a way. I just had been inhabiting a different world. And I think that's a little bit what was happening in Kitty's life on the island. She stayed on the island. Her family moved to the mainland for school for various reasons. So I wouldn't do that literally, but I did do it a little bit metaphorically. Mm. But I also, my husband's got an all-male book group and this came up and they were quite disapproving of this side of Kitty. But, like, there's one guy in the book group who is a surgeon and I just looked at him when I was at this book group and I just thought, how absent have you been in your family's life, mate? There's a whole lot of things that we judge women for that we wouldn't judge men for, but that kind of presence and absence. Oh, and the other thing, Kitty's very handy with a gun. Mm. I'm extremely anti-gun, but I also couldn't see a way that Kitty would not have a gun and be handy with it living in that kind of world. And, I mean, guns are omnipresent wherever you go there. Even like these lovely people who told me, you know, oh, we're not gun people at all. And they said, oh, except for that one we've got in the shed. But that's, you know, that's not really a real gun. It's not like we don't have house guns. We've just got those other guns.
She's a ferocious character. And I had the joy of chatting to Alice Robinson recently about her book. And we talked about yours as well, her book, The Glad Shout. And she was saying about how it was so important to her to write a heroic female character who was guiding a family through a crisis, which is very much what Kitty does. Did you grapple at all with getting Kitty's ferocity onto the page in terms of, because her voice is one thing and her actions are another, and sometimes they always fit beautifully together because she's such an incredible character, but sometimes there's a real tension in there too.
Yeah, I think there's this funny thing that happens when you're writing that a little bit of yourself comes out in your writing. There is this sort of faint porosity between yourself and your character. And I think there, while I was writing her and events would unfold, I would just see a little way ahead and I'd think, oh, no, I think she's going to shoot someone. You know, don't do that, Kitty. On the other hand, I would think, no, it's Kitty. And I would just think, you be you, Kitty. Don't let me judge you out of this action. That's what you would do. And I felt more and more confident about it. And sometimes I would almost feel like I was standing there holding a gun and I'd be thinking, is this person going to die or not die? Like, which way is Kitty going to go? And I would just feel this kind of, will she hold back a little bit? How ruthless is she going to be? How ferocious will she be to protect the people that she loves? And I think that's such an interesting point about Alice's book, this kind of, and also with your new book that I'm going to be so interested to read, this thing of mothers and grandmothers presumably too, being prepared to take flight and with a view to protecting their families. And I'm so interested in this kind of pattern that seems to be, I mean, I probably wouldn't want to push the point too far, but just this idea of people are looking around thinking, the world is not quite safe. What yes, might we do?
Absolutely.
And I think it is just, I find it so fascinating that it's women who are doing it, because yeah, they're thinking family, have to protect family. That's the first thing they're thinking. How would we do that?
How would we do it? Yeah. I want to ask you about that, because your book, like Alice's, like Meg Mundell's, like Laura Jean McKay's, which has come out at the moment, they're all books which have been described as very prescient. They're imagining a very near future, but Wolf Island feels also like a parallel present, really. Refugees flee from the south to the north. They're chased by hunters. Wariness abounds. That idea of vigilance from all towards all is the norm. How did you cope with, and I suppose observe, that tilt towards social breakdown that has happened in around the globe, but particularly in Australia, first with the fires over summer and then with COVID? How were you observing that, I suppose, knowing that you'd written this book, which looks at the same kind of ideas?
Yeah, no, it's really strange, isn't it? The way the world, I was thinking about your book while I'm thinking about this, that we're observing, all of us, I think, a kind of similar, a similar crumbling of civility, of what we think of as civilization, and trying to work out how we, not only how we write it, but how do we live with it ourselves? What do we do with that information? And watching that COVID crisis happening, I just thought, oh, interesting, that's another one of those flight instigators. And I've just noticed there's been a few articles coming out that are just talking about people who are deciding to leave the city. Why would we stay in the city? The cities are not safe places. And it's such a shift in Australia that we always think, you live in the city, your cost of services, employment, blah, blah, blah. But I think that there's going to be more and more of this shift towards living in country towns or outside country towns, even of this kind of fragmenting, a kind of social fragmentation, and of the world being held together in this virtual way like we're doing here now. Yeah, and so I think when people actually do come into contact, it feels a little bit transgressive and also not quite normal, as if we've sort of forgotten how to yes, be around people. What is it like when you go out with friends? Like, it's great, but also what do we do again? Like, how do we yes, get back into that feeling of being comfortable with each other? So watching that, and so if that's happening with friends, it's happening even more with people who are a little bit politically divided, or, you know, politically at different ends of the spectrum. There is more of that. There's that kind of heightened feeling of distrust. And I think that feeling of distrust was something that was happening on Kitty's journeys.
Yes.
You know, who are the safe people? Who are the, how do you respond to the people who automatically assume that you're dangerous or an interloper, or that you might take things from them? And I think we see a lot of that, this kind of instant, you know, people at loggerheads just assuming that each other is the enemy. Mm. Yeah, and how we get through that as a period, I'm not really sure. But I think that's one of the things that we're all looking at.
What do you think, as you said before, Kitty is an artist, as you are, as we are as writers. What is the role of writers during a time of crisis? Is it to observe? Is it to record, to entertain, to spur to action? How are you framing your role as an artist during these times?
It is one of those kind of eternal questions, I think. And I don't feel a great responsibility to make kind of profound statements that I think people might choose to read as advice. I don't have advice to give. I am muddling along the same as everyone else, thinking, bloody hell, what is going on out there, and being alarmed by it. But I do think one of the things that writers do incredibly well is articulate feelings that a lot of people are experiencing. And that's not a trivial thing to do. If you've got a whole, you know, community, a world, country that is feeling sort of jagged, fragmenting, deeply anxious, concerned about the future, and someone articulates not only that moment, but what are the possibilities that arise out of that moment, I think that is a huge service in a way. But that doesn't mean that that's the writer's purpose to perform that service. I think the writer's job, I shouldn't say that because I don't think it's an absolute. The writer's got lots of jobs and there's lots of different ways of being a writer. But I think for me, I just want to write what seems to be true about this character, this world that I'm creating, and what people take out of that is up to them. And I'm really interested in the kind of variety of things that people take out of it. Some people take advice. Some people are just unsettled because of an evocation of time or place or situation. And some people are just, you know, they're kind of relieved that someone has made some kind of comment or articulated something about the unease that they feel themselves.
What's been your favourite reader feedback so far on Wolf Island, Lucy?
It is funny. I occasionally do look at Goodreads reviews and I get a laugh out of some of them.
We've got to get something out of them, don't we?
Just think, good for you, sweetie. I hope you feel better having said that. Look, I really mind what people think, but I really like people to respond to have felt something. If I feel that people have felt something, I like to feel something when I'm reading. I admire a whole lot of highly intellectual writing, but I don't think, wow, I feel like I have been communicated with. I think, interesting. I love to feel like I have been emotionally transported somewhere. And if I have that feeling, or if I feel that people have, if they feel that I have communicated something to them that addresses where they are themselves in their lives, I'm incredibly happy about that. But occasionally someone will just, like, I kept on thinking when I was writing Wolf Island, what I really want to write is a novel that's set a little bit in the future, but that feels like it's set in the past. There's one review that said, it feels like an historical novel that's set a little bit in the future. And I thought, yes, I love you.
You've got me. Yes, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Lucy, you wrote a wonderful essay for the most recent Mianjin, the winter Mianjin, called Writing the Apocalypse. And in it, you lament the kind of categorization of writing about the climate crisis as dystopia or cli-fi, and you wonder how this present moment, both of the fires, really concentrating on the fires, and of the accelerating crisis around us, will be reflected in realist fiction. Can you talk a little bit about your thinking behind that piece?
Yeah, it's kind of, I've been extremely anxious about that piece, and I think it is just because of I worry about a kind of implied judgment about it. But I also think that there is this kind of gap that's opening up between what we call realist fiction and the actual world that we live in, and that seems to be, it's growing wider to me. That I sometimes look at things and I look at writing and I think, where is the worry? Like, yeah. I don't know anyone who is not deeply anxious about the future. Yeah. And it's not only people with children, although there's a kind of added stake in it there, but anyone who cares about the world, the state of the world, the state of the environment, the inaction of governments worldwide, the vile influence of Rupert Murdoch in democracy. I just don't know anyone who doesn't think about that stuff, but I so rarely see that reflected in a realist fiction. And I suppose my point really is, why can't we have some of that information in passing? Mm. It doesn't have to be the subject of a book to be present in it and reflected in it. And I mean, it is part of my ongoing conversation. What am I going to do in this new book? What am I going to say about climate or the COVID crisis? Am I going to write as if we're in the middle of that, as if we're after it? I don't really want to be writing about it, but at the moment I'm just kind of grappling with letting it be present and an event not being resolution. And that's one of the problems that people have writing climate change, I think, that there's no kind of known outcome.
Yeah.
It's all speculative. But also a lot of realist fiction that gets written is a kind of speculative fiction itself, as if the premise of a lot of books is, let's just pretend that none of that climate stuff is happening. Onward we go. So that's as speculative in its way as any other speculative fiction. And yet climate fiction is sold as climate fiction, and realist fiction is not sold as not realist fiction.
You said, and I love this line, you said for the mostly urban population here in Australia, climate change is still somewhat distant, though we have felt its breath. And I think, you know, this enormous period of change we've just lived through, what feels like an enormous period because we have so felt the breath of these crises. Lucy, one of the themes behind Warm Winter Words in 2020, fittingly, is hindsight and also insight. And your novel so beautifully kind of encapsulate this. Your debut was historical fiction, you know, with this elegant structure of Hester Finch looking back on her life with hindsight. And Wolf Island, of course, is a novel that could be read as foresight, looking into the future. Having traversed both the past and the future in your fiction, did you find one easier than the other, Lucy?
Yeah, I found the historical a lot easier. I don't know if you found that.
Well, I think, too, when you've got the bones of a story and you've got the bones of historical record, they're like perfect little plot points, aren't they, that you just have to follow. But having to make the whole thing up.
Definitely didn't happen. Yeah.
It's
very different. But I did want them, they kind of act as bookends to me. One is about the beginning of colonialism, you know, how do we begin to destroy a country? And Wolf Island is about, you know, what happens when you have destroyed the world? Well, islands start disappearing. That's what happens. So it's kind of the end of colonialism, capitalism.
So without jinxing you or anything, can you tell us where you move to then with your third novel, Lucy? Just in terms of where it fits between those bookends.
You know, when I wrote Wolf Island, I thought, yeah, I'm going to a completely different bit of the world. It's nothing like Salt Creek. And then I had a couple of people saying, oh, you're writing in exactly the same kind of setting. It's an estuary. And I just thought, oh, I suppose it is. So anyhow, I thought, this time I'm going inland. I'm completely avoiding water.
And okay, you're going away from water.
Deliberate, no water. But I keep thinking of these watery metaphors anyway, like the desert seas and anyhow, I don't know how.
I will tell. We'll have to come back and check in with you to see if there is indeed water in novel three. The image that has so stuck with me from Wolf Island is the image of and it's not a spoiler, of Kitty dropping seeds behind her so that other runners might have something to eat as they trek. And it's an act both of hope and of unconditional kindness. How do you find hope and how do you write hope in times that are so dark and challenging at the moment, Lucy?
Yeah, it is really hard, isn't it? I suppose for me, hope doesn't happen in a kind of general organisational sense. I don't see it being expressed by the government. I don't see them acting in a way that would encourage us to have hope. But I do see an enormous number of acts of individual, not just kindness, but good. And I see that kind of thing happening in small organisations as well, these kind of impulses towards doing things altruistically. And I think it's been incredibly moving. Some of the lovely things that have happened during the COVID crisis is those community things, people looking out for neighbours, you know, going and doing their shopping, taking them around, making sure they're all right, the kind of outpouring finally. Of care about Black Lives Matter, and those kind of community trying to revegetate landscapes, to restore landscapes, individuals on their farms trying to restore the previously existing landscapes. I think there's a huge amount in that, and how that would translate to a kind of collective action, I think is, yeah, that's one of those things that is the kind of difficulty, that you can have a huge number of individual acts, but organising that to something larger is slightly more problematic, although I see a lot of organisations that are doing that, and I, you know, I feel a bit hopeless on the kind of public side of things, so I just think I'll give them, you know, I'll donate anytime a little bit of money comes in. I just send some money out to whatever organisation seems to be doing something that's incredibly positive. Yeah, so I see no hope in government. I hate them bitterly. I think they're grossly, criminally negligent and irresponsible, and yet that's what we've got. And so we have to find hope away from that.
I'm going to ask a question from one of your fellow authors, one of the other panellists, the author Tony Birch, who asks you, Lucy, when do you know it's time to put the research to one side and let the story reveal itself?
Yeah, I think I probably keep doing research the whole time that I'm writing. And I very often, I never really let it go. And in fact, I still read what's happening in the Coorong. I still read about what's happening in the States, and especially around the Chesapeake Bay. I subscribe to all of these kind of update environmental websites for the Chesapeake Bay and actions they're taking to kind of look after that watershed. So it just doesn't stop for me. Those worlds kind of continue, but all of that research while I'm writing seems to kind of change the trajectory of books. Mm. Like it affects the way plot develops the whole time, and the kind of difficulty of sometimes in the aftermath of writing, of sending your book off to the publisher, is some new fact will emerge and I just think, I definitely would have put that in somewhere. That would have changed that little bit. And I love that kind of dynamic process in writing, the kind of connections between, you know, what is actually happening and what you choose to depict on the page. Yeah, you must have had this with your book as well, this kind of the weirdness of this, you know, the documentation, the
absolutely
phones and absolutely things like that, tracking people.
And if you keep your Google alerts on, as you're saying, yes, then you just keep getting these articles and thinking, oh, yeah, gosh, that's pushed it a little bit further. I need to do it, yeah, now. Lucy, do you keep your notes handwritten? Do you have big files? How do you keep all of your research?
I've got little notebooky things that I lug around with me.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and I, you know, I think I must have picked up every wildlife pamphlet that existed across the Chesapeake Bay. Every time I went in anywhere, I just go, I have one of those, and I pick up a little gun catalogue from the gun shop, and I pick up, I get very squirrely about the whole thing. I think I've got this, like, a hoard of nuts, and I just kind of rifle through my notebooks and things like that. They're very disorganised, so I've got, like, four or five notebooks on the go at any one time. And I just think, I know I wrote something about that. Which, yes, notebook colour was that? Yes, yeah,
that's chaotic, exactly, searching back through, isn't it?
Yeah.
To,
yeah,
try and find.
Yeah.
Barb Burkett, who is from Apollo Bay, asks, well, she says, I think the two dogs, Girl and Hurtle, are the most wonderful depictions of canines, and their relationships with Kitty were heartwarming and heartbreaking. A dog's relationship to the world is straightforward and instinctive. Were the dogs such strongly realised characters to counteract or highlight some of the uncertainty and deviousness shown by the human characters in the novel?
Yeah, that's such an interesting way of looking at them. Sometimes readers notice things that you don't notice yourself as a writer. I think for me that they represent something that is more straightforward. They lack that kind of subterfuge that people, you know, people conceal themselves from other people. And dogs have a kind of purity about them. So, I mean, they are incredibly important, and getting a dog right on the page, they're as individual as people, is really important to me. So if I see a dog that's just used as a kind of device, I just think that is not a dog. Like, you've got a dog-shaped thing in your book, but it's not a dog. You show me that dog as an individual character and I'll believe it. They're just so various. Yeah, as soon as I know what kind of dog a character will have, I know more about the character.
That's wonderful. And obviously for yourself as a as a dog owner, which I know that you are, that is a deep tell of character in knowing that connection.
It is. And sometimes one of my dogs is a little bit, well, I don't want to say strange, because I can feel the children saying, don't be mean. Like, but I look at him sometimes and I think, am I really responsible for the way you operate in the world? Look, I've done my best with you, okay? they do tell a lot about people, and the way people interact with dogs tells you a lot about them.
Dave Rees, who's also from Apollo Bay, says, in Apollo Bay, we can easily identify with the problems of sea level rise and the sense of the world crumbling around us as our coastline erodes. He asked, did you consciously choose water to be a symbol of upheaval and uncertainty?
Yeah, I think I probably wouldn't have I don't choose a setting in a conscious way. It is only that thing that grabs me. But I think you're absolutely right that one of the reasons why water is such a useful emotionally resonant metaphor is because of the built-in built-in potential loss of everything around it. And I was definitely aware the whole time I was writing of the kind of metaphorical nature of that watery world, that while the water is crumbling the landscape, crumbling is happening in all sorts of other places. It's happening in the social fabric of life, in kind of social institutions, politically, including geopolitically, in terms of climate effects and the effects of climate change on whole populations in South America in this case, but it'll be the same in Australia as well. So absolutely, the metaphorical nature of water in a landscape is, and in people's lives is huge. And watery places are always at the front, they're the front lines. I mean, at Apollo Bay, you're at the front lines of where change is going to happen.
Karina, who's from Summers, continues this kind of line of questioning. She says, again, anyone living near a coastline in Victoria will have witnessed the ever-rising tides and the disappearing beaches. She asks on a more practical level, Lucy, do you believe that we should be taking definitive action to vacate seasides?
Ooh, well, I mean, that would be up to the people who live on the seaside. But I do look at real estate in the Bayside suburbs and the coastal towns. And I just think I would not be buying there. I just wouldn't. And my darling daughter and my mother had this conversation at our beach house in the summer. And, you know, they were standing at this cliff top and they were saying, do you think that the water rising is going to ruin the beach, or do you think the cliffs will collapse first? Which do you think is going to happen? This is the kind of conversations that we're having. And we're all standing there on this very, very unstable coastline talking about what's going to happen next.
This is where you say it's not the speculation. It is so present in our lives. Every day it's become so normal.
And at those beachside towns, I don't really know what I would do, but I think they're just the most incredibly precious, beautiful places. Mm. Irrespective of whether people are living on them, they should be being protected at all possible costs. And the fact that we don't have a government that's taking this seriously, I think is shocking. And I feel desperately for people who live in those towns, who adore them, as I, you know, love the beach place that I go to. We feel this incredible connection to those places. Yeah, they seem to matter more than other places.
I think they do. We experienced bushfire in our summer place in Gippsland, where we camp this year, and it was lost, and all our camping gear lost along with it, which wasn't at all important in the scheme of things. But seeing the photographs of the place just have been very devastating.
Yeah.
Sally actually asks about this. Sally's in Malvern. She wants to know if your experience of the recent summer bushfires and the current pandemic would have changed the way you approached or wrote Wolf Island had you been writing it now after those experiences.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure, because the environmental devastation that I was writing about was appropriate for the place that I was writing. And to me, they are the environmental devastation that we experienced in Australia in the summer was another side of exactly the same coin. Yes. That is that, you know, we're experiencing the extremities of heat and the effects of a rapidly drying landscape. But they're experiencing the effects of an extremely shallow landmass and rising water. But it is that best thing that the American novelist William Gibson says, that the future, you know, that it's all, the future is here already. It's just not evenly distributed. Yes. And, you know, we've got fire, they've got flood. And we kind of think, oh, the flood happened to us. And they think those fires in Australia, poor things. But we should all be thinking the fire could be here next, you know, extrapolating from those situations. Or what is the thing that's going to hit us? What's the thing that's going to desperately affect us?
Yeah. The final question is a craft question from Janet in Eltham, who admires your writing very much, and she wonders how much reworking you do and, in particular, how you feel about pesky adverbs.
Adverbs. Oh, yeah, I really don't like adverbs. Yeah. Adverbs are pretty easy to get rid of, actually. I've heard this from, I can't remember, I did a masterclass with a writer once, and she said, you just do an L-Y space search.
Oh, then you just find them all. That's a great idea.
You don't delete them all, but you really interrogate each one.
Yeah, excellent idea.
Yeah. So, yes, I don't like adverbs. Yeah, I love refining language. I'm always really happy doing the editing side of things, but it's getting the first draft out that just nearly kills me. Just inventing stuff. I just think, you know what happens, like they're in the bush stuff. But you have to write the whole stuff, all of it out.
You do have to write it all out.
It's just killing that first draft, yeah. So, but the editing I love.
Well, we wish you speed towards the editing, Lucy. Oh. I know we're speaking to book lovers today, and especially at this time, I want everyone to be seeking out books and supporting their local booksellers if they can. So to help with that, can you tell us what you're reading and if there's anything you can recommend right now?
Kevin, what is his name? I haven't got it here on my desk. Nightboat to Tangier.
Okay.
Kevin, is it?
That's all right. We'll find it and we'll put a link in.
Loving it. It's just got the most wonderful voice. So it's got, I'm listening to it on audio and I'm reading it as well. And I don't care if I kind of double up. It's just so great. And then I came across this fantastic book, Lydia Davis on.
Oh, wow.
It is going to be a kind of Bible to me, I can just tell. She interrogates her own writing practice in this really, really fascinating way. She's absolutely wonderful. A book that I really loved this year was Peggy Frew's Islands. I think that's fantastic.
It's wonderful.
I loved her book. And a book that has been not read as much as it should be is Carrie Tiffany's Exploded View. It has been shortlisted for the Miles Franklin. Just the discipline of that kind of writing fills me with admiration. I could never do it myself. And it's kind of grim but fascinating and admirable writing of the highest order. It's really excellent. Yeah, so they're just a few of the books that I've been thinking at.
Wonderful. Lucy Treloar, it is always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for sharing your writing life with us and the people of Apollo Bay today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's just been such a pleasure.
To find out more about Warm Winter Words, Apollo Bay WordFest, or any of our featured authors, you can go to apollobaywordfest.com. We are grateful for the support of Writers Victoria and the Grace Marion Wilson Trust and Colac Otway Shire. You can purchase books by all of our guests from readings. We look forward to gathering together in 2021 and welcoming you to Apollo Bay for WordFest.